right, folks, welcome back to the Game Trail Podcast. I have a special guest today. I've been following this gentleman, Henry Ferguson. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Gotcha. So I've been following Henry for a while. I don't know that we've ever met in person, but you've been on my radar and kind of on my list of guests that I would like to get on for a multitude of reasons. One of them primarily being that you just seem to always kill giant mule deer. So I wanted to kind of pick your brain about that and kind of learn a little bit more. I also kind of wanted to explore some topics that are more specific to Colorado, which is where you live. So we'll dive into that. Before I get going with Henry, I do want to hit you guys with the promo code. You can use the promo code GAMETRAIL. If you want to sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account, you're going to get $50 back in the Go Hunt gear shop. You can use that towards a purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. And we are in full tilt research season. So I played the game today in Idaho trying to get a tag, which was pretty interesting. And We can probably talk a little bit about that. I want to know if Henry played that game as well. He probably didn't, being he's a Colorado resident, but
I didn't. And the reason I didn't is because my falls are usually pretty busy with between my hunts. My wife usually grab her a tag or two, and then my son. So it doesn't leave me a ton of time to hunt out of state. So
yeah. That's one of those things is being if you're a resident of Wyoming or Colorado or Idaho or even Montana, there's like those states that if you're a resident, there's really not a ton of need to go anywhere else to hunt because you guys can draw permits. You can put permits in your pocket over the counter and you can go hunting.
Yeah, it's getting harder every year, I'll tell you. It is getting to be a challenge. And I do think that, you know, you better have a multi-state strategy or you're going to be sitting on the sidelines a lot. And that's not, it's just not an option, you know?
Sure. Yeah. But, well, I played the game in Idaho this morning. So,
well, how'd the big tag rodeo go for you? Did you get one? Are you going to Idaho?
I did get one, but it didn't come from, the online version. So I logged in 10 AM, got my random number. My random number was like 20,290, I think.
Yikes. I saw Brady's was like 48,000.
That was my favorite is when I was feeling kind of bad and picked on for getting a, you know, 20,000 number. I looked at and saw Brady's number. He's almost 50,000.
In other words, better luck next time, Brady. Yeah.
So that was kind of funny. I had a couple of friends that actually went up in person and they had reached out and said, hey, if you want me to try to pick up a permit, let me know. The one guy was trying to buy, I want to say 4 tags, which I was like, I don't know, you're going to be in line. And then the other guy was only buying for himself. And so I gave him a list of units and he was actually able to pick me up a permit. So I got, it wasn't my first choice by any means. It was way down the list, but I did grab a tag. But the other guy, he said he was trying to buy tags for himself, his dad, and his brother. And he said by the time he got to his brother, so the third tag, and I think he was like fourth in line, he said the crowd behind him was getting pretty angsty. The
natives were getting restless.
Yeah, and guys were saying, yeah, he said it actually got pretty hostile. He's like, I actually thought there for a minute I might end up in a fist fight. So he's like, I just made do the best I could, got out and got my tags and got on the road. But yeah, it's getting harder for sure. I don't know why Idaho does that the way that they do it. Part of me thinks that they must like it. I don't know. It's just kind of strange. It's like I was telling him, I said, this is like the Black Friday of old, you know, when people used to line up at Target and fight over a Cabbage Patch doll or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Watch Jingle All the Way just to prepare for it.
Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I did get a tag. But give me some background on you. I don't know that we've ever met in face to face.
We never have, no.
Yeah, I've followed along with you a long time. You're a good follow on social media. You post a lot of big deer, and it seems like you must get out a lot. And you're also big into archery, which I want to pick your brain about and talk bow hunting, which is probably where I came on to you. But where are you from? What do you do for a living?
Well, so I'm actually from Northern Idaho. I was born up there and then kind of raised in Nevada and Arizona. Moved to Colorado in 94. I sell furniture to furniture stores. That's my my day job. It's super exciting, not at all frustrating. It's 100% commission job, which is a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing during September when I can say, hey guys, I might be a little bit difficult to get a hold of here for a little while,
right.
But then I bring them jerky at the end of it and everything's great. You know, all is forgiven. And, so that's kind of what I do. I'm married. My wife and I've been married for, I guess, like 27 years. She's a very, very lucky woman. We have a son named Kyle and he's 18 and, is a freshman at Adams State University here in Colorado. And he's there on a partial lacrosse scholarship. So
gotcha. Yeah. How did you fall into selling furniture? And was that by design so that you had free time to take off in the fall?
To be honest, I made some poor choices in my youth trail and it led me down this life. I honestly took a summer job at a family furniture store in Salt Lake City when I was just right out of high school. And it was literally going to be a summer job. And that's just not how it turned out. I started on the retail side. I was delivering furniture and that's what I thought I was going to do there. Mm-hmm. And then like most people within the industry, if you have like a pulse, and you can fog a mirror and you can maybe carry a conversation with a person, they're going to find something else for you. And that's exactly what happened. So found myself selling and then, I'd been there for about 3 years and I got an opportunity to come over to Colorado as a wholesale rep. And I looked at those guys. I thought, man, they dress nice. They drive nice cars. Don't really seem to be working all that hard. And I thought, man, that could be the life for me. Mm-hmm. So they got me under that, got me in under that. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of stress, but you know, it's what it is. And now it's kind of evolved and takes me over to Asia once or twice a year. And, you know, we do a few trade shows around the country. And so there's just like any job now, you know, if you've been at it for any period of time, it usually doesn't resemble what you hired on to do. And that's exactly where I find myself.
Yeah. Do you, based on kind of the direction that you've gone, and I mean, you've got an 18-year-old boy, I've got a 19-year-old boy as well. He lives here in my basement and, he's a freshman going to Southern Utah University here, but do you give your son kind of some guidance? Cause I know he likes to hunt too, right?
He loves it. Yeah. He absolutely loves it. And I've told him over and over he's kind of not certain what that future career path looks like right now, but I've told him, hey, you know, a guy with your personality. And then obviously, you know, being my son, he's a ridiculously good looking guy. So, you know, sales is not a bad way to go. But he's a great photographer and I think that's what he really wants to do. So we'll see if that's a path that he can really take. I mean, he's gotten really interested in kind of the political stuff because of the role I've had with the Colorado Bow Hunters Association for the last few years. He's actually gone to commission meetings and testified in front of the Wildlife Commission. And so he's just gotten really interested in that. So that's a path that he may take and who knows, you know, I mean, hey, he's 18. There's a lot of time. Trust me, when I was 18, my thoughts were not leading me to furniture wrap. But, you know, hey, here we are. I'm 51 now and it's done all right for me. So, you know, sometimes you just have to be open to the opportunities that present themselves too. So
for sure. Yeah. My 19-year-old, I keep telling him, you know, try to find a job that offers you a decent living that you can provide for a family, but then also offers you some free time, you know? And
huge.
Yeah. Yeah. He thinks he wants to be a commercial pilot. It's probably maybe partly my fault. I got a buddy that I went to high school with. That's a commercial pilot and he loves to bow hunt, this guy. And I was talking to him one day about his schedule and he was telling me how many days he actually flies a month. and then the amount of time, the vacation time that he can take off, and the salary is pretty good. So he's my kids thinking he wants to be a pilot, but
there's worse ways to make a living for sure.
For sure. Yeah. I know that when I was 18, I wasn't thinking about any of that. I was just like, yeah, we'll figure it out. But
yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Let's get into that was a good lead in. I was interested in your role with the Colorado Bowhunters Association. So what role did you have there and for how long?
So I actually got on the board of directors there in 2016, like late 2016. And I was just a director at large, which means I showed up and casted votes at board meetings. Wasn't super heavily involved, and the organization went through some changes. We had our chairman actually passed away, had a massive heart attack and was just gone. And he was an amazing guy named Mike Yeary. And what that did is it kind of forced a lot of people to step up. And they kind of looked in my direction, and I'm like, hey, I'm just here to make sarcastic comments. I mean, I take my work very seriously, but that's, you know, they thought maybe I was capable of a little more. So they made me director of, or vice chair of public relations. So basically I ran our social media. I got us on Instagram, you know, press releases, that kind of stuff. And it was a good position for me. And I think it was one that fit me pretty well. And then a year later, the acting chairman who took over after Mike passed away, a guy named Gerald Rasmussen, looked at me and he goes, "Hey, Henry, by the way, I think you're going to be the next chairman." I'm like, "I think you should probably reconsider that, Gerald. That's not me." And after 3 years of being chairman, I still think, no, that's not me. But but man, we faced a lot. We had a lot of things. They were throwing fastballs at us, man, and it was kind of crazy. I mean, when I came in, we literally were up against having to wear blaze orange during the muzzleloader overlap. And we were told very, very certainly from some very high ranking people, "Hey, this is not the hill you want to die on. You don't have a chance of winning this. I'd pick a different fight." And I told him right then, and I'd been chairman for all of about 3 weeks at this point. Keep in mind, volunteer position, no pay, just a lot of work. And so I said, "Man, if we didn't stand up and fight for this, we would have no reason or right to ever ask for anybody to renew their membership in this organization."
Yeah.
So we stood up and fought it, and we won it unanimously. It was an 11-0 vote in favor of the bow hunters. So that was a good win for us. And then, man, it's been constant here, you know, this mountain lion thing that you guys had a huge role in that. And that was actually round three of that. We had fought just over the last 3 years. The first one was at the legislature. They tried to get it passed there. Then they tried to get it passed at the commission. And then in the actual ballot measure where every legal voter in the state had an opportunity to vote on it. And just a crazy time. But man, people like you guys and Go Hunt, I've thanked you, you know, just over DMs, and I've thanked Brady as well. But please pass along on behalf of everybody in the state of Colorado to everybody there at Go Hunt. That was huge. I mean, you shared your platform, and so many people did. And that's what I think that was a key to to victory for us. And but it's been stuff like that. And then this last year, and I know one other thing you wanted to talk about, it was the one we faced last year, which was OTC elk. I mean, just to give you, do you mind if I kind of go into how happened?
It's on the list of questions I want to ask.
Yeah, and there's a big misperception about how that happened and how, you know, I know there's some people who say, well, as the residents of Colorado got the non-residents shut out. But they came forth with three options. And that was CPW staff brought three options forward last year for the commission. The first one was everybody go limited entry. And so resident, non-resident alike. The second alternative was non-residents go draw, residents remain over the counter. And the third was status quo. So zero changes. Well, it took all of about 5 minutes of discussion for the bot, for the last one to drop off the table. They realized that status quo was not an option. Simply put, there was a crowding problem. There's no question about it. There were a lot of people out there. Just like what you were talking about with Idaho, there's a big competition for a finite resource. And that's what the West is facing right now all over the place. So when you see states like Colorado, who have always been very, very generous with tag allocations, making changes like this, it's time to start paying attention, because the good old days are gone. So we looked at it and said, okay, we need to maintain as, and it says right in our bylaws, and our organization's motto says that we are to basically maintain and facilitate growth in hunting opportunity across the state of Colorado. The only way we could do that was to keep residents and limit non-residents. So a couple things to keep in mind. And now, first of all, we went through that big, lots of discussion happened in that. A lot of people showed up to vote and to, or rather to make their opinions known. And it had a positive impact, and we were able to maintain residents keeping OTC.
Do you have any insight as to why archery remained OTC for residents and went to a draw for non-residents, and then they retained second and third rifle season is still OTC?
I sure do. And it's quite simple. There's a lot of money in this. Sure. And I mean, this is, I'm not saying that is a, hey, CPW is greedy. The fact is they have a budget and they have people that they need to employ to make their plans work. Sure. And their plans are to grow wildlife populations all across the state of Colorado. And in my estimation, they do a damn fine job of that. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I want to get out there right off the bat. I don't begrudge them their budget. They need it. If we want to have animals to hunt, they are a vital part of that. So
you sound just like me. One of my biggest pet peeves, I worked for the division. It's not really any secret, but I worked for the Division of Wildlife here in Utah. And, you know, anytime any kind of proposed management change or any kind of idea, you go to a public meeting, anything's ever proposed, there's this, probably within two or three comments, there'll be somebody that jumps in and they're like, oh, the division, you know, they're always trying to make money. And I'm like, you know, I've worked for the division. The reason I don't work for the division is because there's no money in it. Like, nobody's driving brand new pickup trucks and living in huge houses. You know, I mean, this is, and the people that work there that I know, I mean, the big game coordinator for the state of Utah is one of the most down to earth people I know, like genuinely to his core, wants to see the best things for wildlife. And one of my biggest pet peeves is that people say, oh, it's just for the money. It's just for the money. I'm like,
it drives me crazy.
Me too. It takes money to manage wildlife.
Absolutely. There's not one bit of that that's free. Yeah. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. It needs our participation. And quite honestly, it needs our dollars.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I just, hey, trust me, I paid $1,000 in 23 for a Utah tag that was anything but the quality that I expected. But you know what? That was my price to participate. Sure. I don't begrudge that. I should have chosen better, but that's a different story for a different time. But, but as we went into this, and one of the great things about this role that I've had at the Colorado Bowhunters Association is being able to work with some of the top dogs at CPW, and I will echo exactly what you just said about Utah's. These are good people. These are really good people, and they have that job because they care about the wildlife. And I could sit here and name names, but I had a lunch meeting with myself and Lane Walter, our CPW liaison. We had a lunch meeting with five of the top people there last year while we were discussing this OTC elk. And I am here to tell you, there was not a person at that table that didn't hunt. There wasn't a person at that table who didn't care about wildlife. And without that, man, that this whole thing just doesn't work.
I agree. Do you have any kind of indication as to how permit numbers will be set for non-residents for those? Yeah.
I don't yet, but I will tell you this. I mean, it's going to be generous. There's going to be, I would be stunned if people applied next year and didn't draw. And there's going to be, and one of the things that they kept discussing was that there's going to be a certain number of people who drop off just because they don't want to get into a draw process.
Sure.
And I know that there's a lot of states, especially back east, where they don't have to draw for anything. They can go to the convenience store or Walmart and buy their, stack of deer tags and go out and, shoot five does and a buck. And I mean, it's as crazy and foreign as that seems to us out west, that's the reality. And so a certain number of people are just going to fall off because of that. So they are looking to reduce the number of non-residents last year. And one of the things that not everybody realizes is that over the last few years, Colorado has had a very unique situation in that we have not limited the number of over-the-counter tags sold, whether resident or non-resident. And as a result, there have been, I think over the last 5 years, more non-residents in the field than residents. Now, if a change needed to be made somewhere, I mean, even the non-residents would look at that and go, yeah, that might not be fair. Yeah.
It's not. And I agree. I was a proponent of it going to a draw, to be honest, for non-residents.
To a full draw?
Yeah.
Or
for non-residents, for archery. Yeah. I mean, I get the fact that like second and third rifle season is kind of a, it's a money
plan. It's a cash cow.
And you need the funding.
I
get that, but I was actually in favor of it in regards to, I think that if you are a resident of a state, you should have some benefit of being in that state. I think you should have the ability to have a little less pressure, over the counter tags. I mean, you guys have a phenomenal resource. You've got the largest elk herd in the lower 48 or anywhere, I guess, for that matter.
Anywhere.
Anywhere. But I mean, I was completely okay with it. I mean, it's going to, what you guys had become in Colorado is it had become everybody's back pocket. It was
we were plan D.
Yeah.
Plan D. If you didn't draw Utah, New Mexico, Wyoming, or Montana, boy, let's jump right in here and we'll go to Colorado. Colorado will take anybody.
And hit a Cabela's on your way and you buy a tag and you go hunting.
Exactly.
Which I love, but I can certainly see that it comes with some frustrations, especially for
people. Hey, and you played it right, man. You got out here and got one of the last OTC archery elk that a non-resident's going to kill. Good for you, man.
Yeah, I jumped on it, man. I was like, I'm going to buy that tag and go hunt. So I get it.
Yeah.
Is there I was interested about tag numbers. I remember a few years ago when some of those units, like in the southern portion of the state, kind of the southwest side of the state, went from an OTC to a draw. It felt like the number of permits allocated were pretty similar to like some of the hunter surveyed results. It felt like they were super generous.
Yep,
the number of tags. And I remember, so the first year I drew one of those tags as a second choice. I didn't end up hunting it and I turned it back in, but I kind of watched that exact same unit just over the last 2 years, I guess, just to gauge what the demand was. And it does seem that the demand has increased. Like it is going, as people's first or second choice. And it's pretty rare that there's any, on a leftover list. So I think
extremely rare.
Yeah. I think you'll probably see that over the years. I think that most people will, have to kind of spread out and find their opportunities. I'm actually interested to see what it'll do to some of the, like mid-tier draw units.
Oh, I am too. My prediction is that a lot of these 1-point draw tags are going to become real easy to get. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see a lot of these OTC tags. Let's face it, the whole state has a pretty good population of elk.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, that northwest portion got pounded pretty good in that winter of 22-23. But elk are resilient, man. They're going to come back. They are going to come back. I mean, they're not, they're not like deer. They're not like antelope that take a lot more management to make that number come back. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, but yeah. I think there's going to be some feeling out over the next few years. Like you said, just like what you observed in that Southwest part, I think you're going to see that over the next 5 years. But I do think that if people start applying first choice, you're going to be drawing tags.
Yeah. Yeah. If you play the odds, you pick the right unit, and it'll take a few years to kind of play out and see what's available to people. But I think, yeah, I still think that's the thing is like people, I've had non-residents reach out to me and, you know, they're a little bit upset that it can't be their back pocket tag anymore. And I'm like, you know, I get it. I understand it. But reality is if you pick the right unit, you kind of play the game, you'll probably be able to draw any one of those pretty much any given year that you want, you know, one of them. So,
For sure. And we fear change. Hunting.
Yeah.
And the result exactly should be better quality hunts. And I do feel confident that will be the result on this. And I mean, hey, if it's something that a non-resident hunts it 2 out of every 3 years, but has a much better quality hunt, well, I still think that's a win.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I am wondering, I've had several people reach out and say, I'll probably just buy a point and then do the OTC second or third rifle season because they're just trying to fill a permit. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see if those kind of get, you know, hammered because those are still unlimited. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next few years and what the influx is from guys that were doing OTC.
Yeah, and it's going to be that. I think you're exactly right. And I actually hunted... We don't hunt a lot of OTC elk. We'll hunt a 1 point unit. But we hunted this last year with my son going to school down in the south part of the state. We hunted down there and man, I think we met half of Texas there. I wish I was being sarcastic and exaggerating, but we met a lot of Texans down there. And you know what? Every single one of them were great guys. We had great conversations, but it's interesting. I mean, there's some big changes ahead.
Yeah. Has there ever been any talk about separating the muzzleloader hunt from the archery hunt, kind of moving it out to its own hunt? Because to me, that one seems very odd. You know, every other state has a separate season.
Well, it is. And the way it, but it's important to know a little bit of the history on this. Mm-hmm. When this first started, there were a fraction of the number of bow hunters in the state. There were also a fraction of the number of muzzleloader hunters because most people just hunted with a rifle. As the popularity of both of those have grown in the years since, it's become a bit more of an issue. However, it was not, you know, it's still, I mean, there's been three deaths since the 1970s, I think it was late 70s, early 80s when they put that in there. Which is three too many, to be brutally honest. There should be none. And these all went back to gross negligence in every single case. But what's the way this started was there were going to be a cap on the number of a maximum that'll not exceed this number of muzzleloader hunters. And I mean, obviously we're well beyond that now. I don't know how to put that toothpaste back in the tube at this point, but it's not easy. But yeah, there's always discussions around it. And one of the questions that we're always asked is, do you want to put them in the first week of where your season used to be or in the last week of where your season used to be? So it's not an easy thing. And there used to be one of the reasons that the dates are where they are is there used to be a big need to have a couple of weeks in the first part of October to let the cattle work their way back down so they could get in there and drive the cattle off the high country down for the winter. That's not happening as much anymore. They've made a lot of changes in that and they're kind of more fluid. But it's still something that, you know, there's still a lot of old information, a lot of old history that needs to be overcome to get that change made. But
yeah, that is one I would like to see. I know that this last year I was hunting elk and I was working a bull, and I was probably 200, 300 yards from him, and he was going really good, and we were kind of working back and forth, and, you know, I'd cow call and he'd pipe off, and I just felt like I was getting in kind of that red zone where I was like, okay, it's gonna get good. And then I hear a muzzleloader go off, and a guy dropped the bull and killed him. And you know, it went kind of quiet for the evening. And like, that's just the nature of the beast. It's just the way that it is. I mean, that guy obviously beat me to it. Like, he was further down on the hill and had worked in on that bull and, you know, ended
it's
up.
It's nice getting... of you to call him in for him.
Yeah. He ended up getting it killed, but he ended up actually shooting, like a lot of muzzleloaders, it feels like on a bull elk, it often feels like they end up shooting a couple times or three times, but I think he ended up shooting three different times to get that bull killed. But yeah, it was kind of strange. I thought, man, it is the sacrifices that you would have to give something up, right? So you would have to give up maybe 5 or 10 days in the tail end of September, or, you know, the 1st of September, which would be kind of tough as well. So
here's the question. Do you want to take them off the front end and screw the deer hunters, or off the back end and screw the elk hunters?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've already, in my opinion, kind of screwed the deer hunters by losing that last week of August. So we don't have a real great set of options there. Yeah. You know, in the next, we know it won't happen in the next 5-year season structure, 'cause that's already been set. But, I wouldn't mind seeing something proposed to give the muzzleloaders the week after archery. Yeah. So, you know, there's currently like a 2-week between archery and first rifle. So they've also wanted to give them that period so that they can have the rut to make sure the species continues on. So
I get it.
Yeah. Just not a lot of easy decisions to be made there.
Yeah. You brought up that September 2nd archery deer opener. Doesn't open in September or August anymore. So how does that sit for you? How do you feel about it? I don't personally like it.
Well, you know, I'm a deer hunter. Sure. So, so you know how I feel about it. And really it was the CBA that was able to get that done. But when we sent out surveys, our membership was overwhelmingly in favor of it. So that's what we did, you know.
Why?
Yeah, it was something that I sat there and kind of gritted my teeth, but what can we do? You know, hey, we're a member organization, mm-hmm. and we do represent our membership, and that's I still say we. I'm still chairman for like 3 more weeks.
That's right.
But you know, you've heard about like lame duck coaches and stuff where they're done. Yeah, that's me right now.
You'd probably still be involved, I would assume. Yeah, I don't understand that September 2nd opener. It seems tough. I mean, you've got a resource that could be hunted in August. You know, every other state, you've got Utah opens typically like the 17th.
Yeah, we just tried it. We had a proposal in this last 5-year season structure, and this is important to note, we did have one in that would have tied. So currently archery deer is tied to the archery elk dates. Mm-hmm. So that's the 2nd to the 30th. So we also have an archery antelope season that goes from August 15th to September 20th. And we tried to disconnect it from elk and connect it to deer. But which in my humble opinion would have made Colorado the premier destination for archery mule deer in the Western United States. But
for sure.
Unfortunately we did get some resistance on that. CPW came back with a compromise plan, and it unfortunately didn't get through. I didn't love the compromise plan, but I would have accepted it. We literally missed out on that by one vote.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does make people make some decisions. I mean, it really shows it shows people kind of where your alliance is, whether it's more with, you know, archery mule deer or more archery elk, because I mean, every year since it went to that September 2nd opener, I look at it and I'm always thinking, I would love to go there and hunt high country mule deer with a bow, but you know, once I roll into about the 8th, 10th of September, like I want to be chasing elk. And it really does kind of show people's allegiances, you know, like what is your priority, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know, making people choose a little bit. You know, one of these years I'll just have to pick one or the other and, you know, maybe probably pick mule deer, I guess, and burn some points and go hunting. But
as every right-minded person should, but you know,
let's get into that. What made you fall in love with mule deer hunting?
Well, I'll tell you what, it was, I can actually point a finger to a day. Literally, it was the first week of September in 2003. All right.
Okay.
I had always been, I've shot a bow since I was a kid. I mean, I literally have shot a bow since I was 14, but I had, you know, as I kind of got up here and got into my adult life, I just kind of had to make some choices. I could be a tournament shooter. I could be a hunter. And I shot a lot of tournaments for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. And in 2003 or 2002, I started spending a bit more time out in this area and looking around, and I've seen some really good deer. And I was seeing some really good elk, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to shift my priorities next year, and I'm going to go hunt deer and elk. So I got in there, and I had a herd of elk really pinned down. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had these suckers dead to rights as far as my feeble mind was concerned. And they showed me otherwise. But first weekend of that season, I went out and I was looking for deer and elk, and I was just kind of killing time before I got to this really good elk spot, because I knew they were going to kind of move in there in a week or so. And so I was just kind of walking through the woods after the rain, and I found some fresh tracks. I literally followed these fresh tracks along the road. They led back up into this canyon, and I looked up and there was a deer just standing broadside. And I took my giant Bushnell range finder that I had to hold like that. You know, you had to set your bow down back then, grab the range finder, and I clicked on it and it wouldn't give me a number.
Oh man.
I clicked again and it wouldn't give me a number. And I'm like, oh my gosh. By the way, bow hunters now have no idea how good you have it. The technology sucked back then. But years before that, it was even worse. So anyway, so I judged the distance, and I freaking 12 ring that deer, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she ran around it was a doe, and she ran around the bend of this hill and died. I mean, I don't know if my arrow traveled farther or she did after the arrow hit her, but I mean, it was over quick. Gotcha. So I had the whole rest of the season to focus on elk, and I was focused on elk, and I couldn't go anywhere without running into bucks. Hmm. And I'm like, Trail, all I could think was, I should not have shot that doe. I should not have shot that doe. So, and when I say I ran into bucks everywhere I went, I mean, I couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting a buck out here, man. Whoa. It was just nuts. And now, granted, that was the way the herds used to be out here, and 21 years later, it's not quite like that anymore. But yeah, never did run into the elk, never did get a shot at an elk. And I got onto this big bachelor herd of bucks one evening, and I'm like, you know what? The elk aren't showing up here anyway. I'm just going to sneak in. I'm going to leave my bow back here. So there's zero temptation to be an idiot. And so I walked up and I snuck over this hill, got into the oak brush, and I got to like 10 yards on this bedded buck. And he stands up, and I mean, just this big, beautiful 4-point, just majestic. And I sat there and I'm like, I think I'd rather hunt these.
Yeah.
And it just something struck there. And and I love hunting mule deer. What I really love about it is being able to scout them all summer, and, you know, just work on patterning them and get them in, you know, get them kind of figured out, because it'll always change, you know, whether they're in a bachelor herd. Sometimes they'll be solo bucks and end up in bachelor herds, and you know, I just love the chess match that is mule deer hunting.
Yeah.
And I know it's as weird as it sounds, I love the fact that they don't call.
Yeah.
And that it's just me versus the buck, you know, there's,
yeah, I get that.
You can't call them in. You just got to go out and hunt them on their terms. And sometimes you get the best of them, and more often than not, they get the best of you. But
it is funny. I've talked to a bunch of different people, and it feels like there aren't that many people that are really, really good spot and stock mule deer hunters that are also really, really good elk archery hunters.
Yeah. Like, there's a few.
There's a few.
I'm not one of them.
there's a few, but, and I'm not either. Like I'm an okay deer hunter, but I'm a way better elk hunter than I am a deer hunter. And it's interesting how different personalities seem to be drawn to one or the other. You know, the more people I talk to, the more I'm like, okay, yeah, you're probably an archery mule deer guy. You're an archery elk guy. I just don't think I'm sneaky enough to, I mean, every once in a while I'll get a gimme, but for the most part, I just think, I don't know if I'm not quite patient enough, although I would consider myself a pretty patient person, but maybe it's either that or I'm just not quite sneaky enough.
I think patience, you nailed it there, because that is a huge part of being a really consistently successful archery deer hunter. Mm-hmm. You've got to be patient. I mean, this year's a great example, dude. I had a target buck. And now I didn't draw this year. I didn't get it in second choice draw this year. I couldn't find a freaking landowner tag. I literally picked up a tag on, in fact, a buddy of mine logged in for me and got it, because I was in the middle of something with my son. I got a reissued deer tag off the first reissue list. Yeah, so I didn't have a deer tag until that was what, the 13th or 14th of August?
August, yep.
Yeah, so I started I'm always out there looking for deer, but I started aggressively looking for deer at that point. And I mean, I was out there, and nobody from work's listening. I was probably out there 9 times between there and me showing up to hunt on. And I pulled my trailer out there. I think I was in place on like the 30th of August.
Gotcha.
And then I was there. I mean, I was scouting morning and evening from there through the second. I spotted a buck on the 18th, and then I didn't see him again until the 3rd.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or no, the 2nd. Saw him again on the 2nd. And it was just a quick glimpse of him, but I knew it was him. He hadn't had this cheater that was real, really identifiable. So I made a big loop around, and I mean a big loop around, so I could glass back in from the other way, because he kind of disappeared behind this ridge. And I spent the rest of the day glassing that hillside, just getting cooked in the sun, and I never found him again. I literally never saw that deer again. And I was out there every single day until I finally killed a buck on the 12th. That was my birthday, and it was just a birthday present to myself.
Good. Yeah, it was a good buck.
Yeah, he was a nice buck. He was a nice buck, but man,
the other one.
I still look back at it, and I'm like, I know that other deer was out there, and it just kills me that I didn't get that deer. But you know, we had a lot. I mean, personally, we've had a lot of changes at home this year. You know, I mean, my wife never asks me, hey, when are you done? What's the She's always really, probably too understanding. But this year, you know, Kyle's gone at school. I mean, it's just her at the house, her and the dog. And she was like, hey, when are you going to like come home and do laundry? Are you, you know, coming home for it? And so finally I'm like, okay, I can read the subtle or even some of the not so subtle cues, and I'm going to go take care of this. So.
One of the questions I like to ask people that are really specific and they really love archery mule deer hunting is, it's kind of a question that I go back and forth on. So when you go out and you're scouting and you're looking for a buck to hunt, are you looking for a buck and then you find that buck and you're going to hunt him regardless of where he's at? Or are you more looking for the type of terrain that is more applicable to spot and stock archery hunting? Have you ever abandoned a big buck because you're just like, I don't think I can kill that deer where he's at?
Yes. Yes, I have. I have. In fact, in Utah in 23, I spotted a buck that, I went over after him twice and without help, without a spotter back, a mile and a half away where I was glassing him from, there was just no chance.
Right.
But yeah, I do tend to look for conducive terrain. And then within there, I'm looking for the right buck. I'm looking for a buck that gets my heart rate elevated.
Mm-hmm. What kind of terrain are you looking for?
Just open terrain as much as anything else, so I can glass it. Yeah, I mean, not to sound arrogant on it, but I think one of my greatest skills is the ability to sit down and glass. Mm-hmm. If there's something out there, I'm probably going to find it, and but you've got to have open terrain or you're kind of pissing in the wind, if you're sitting there just looking at a sea of pine trees, you're just looking at a sea of pine trees and hoping to catch something moving in between them.
But that's been my problem. I felt like I've found deer, big deer, that I've just fell in love with. And I'm like, I'm going to throw everything at it. And you bring up that buck that you didn't see. I remember a buck that I hunted. It's probably been, I don't know, 8-9 years ago, I would say. But I only ever saw that buck two times. And just thick, thick pinyon juniper country. So sage, pinyon juniper country. Yeah.
That's tough.
When I looked at that country, inevitably in the back of my mind, I'm going, my odds of killing this deer are slim to none. Like, it is so hard to hunt, but he was so big.
that changes your logic. It changes common sense. It changes your everything to be true. You got to go. You got to make a run at it.
Yeah, that's the hard part. Even though reality is, it was just like I sat there most days just thinking I'm probably legitimately just wasting my time, and it would behoove me to go find an area that is more conducive to spot and stock hunting and trying to find a buck there that I could actually kill.
Yeah.
Versus just kind of, blowing chances, just sitting there on the same hillside every day, just not seeing him.
And I hunted a buck in 2018. That this is, 2018 is going to forever be one of my favorite hunting seasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, I spent an absolutely irresponsible amount of time out there in the woods. I spotted a buck, third weekend in July. And mm-hmm. One glance, I'm like, that's it. I'm not looking for anything else. I have found my obsession, and this is it. So I got on that buck and I watched him again from there through the start of the season. I spotted him just about every time out, just about. And every time I spotted him, he was either alone or with one other buck.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's the dream. Loners are just destined to be killed.
They're begging for it.
Yeah. And what do I find opening day of archery season? He's out there and he is one of 13 bucks in this bachelor.
No way.
And I'm like, how? You will never convince me they don't have a calendar. You will never, ever convince me they don't have a calendar. That's crazy. I ended up stalking that deer multiple times. I did get a shot on him at close range. I shot him at 27 yards, and I've never seen a deer absolutely explode on a shot like mm-hmm. that thing did. And I sat there and I was just in tight on him, made a great shot, holding a little bit low, even accounting for him to move a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was just holding right on his heart. That thing went right through the back straps.
No way.
I'm like, unfreaking real. And I talked to Brian Barney about it, and it's kind of he and I have kind of figured out that if that buck's over four, mm-hmm. there's a good chance he's going to be jumping that string. Wow. And so one of the things that I learned that season was I don't want a close shot.
Yeah.
Give me that shot at 60. Give me that shot at 50. Give me that shot at 80. And that deer's not going to react 9 times out of 10. He's just going to sit there and take that arrow. But in close, for one reason or another, and I don't know if it's, I mean, you know, Randy Ulmer's theory is that that's kind of the, you know, 40 and under is kind of that, that mountain lion pouncing, you know, striking sort of zone. I don't know what it is, but I've had a lot of close encounters and they don't tend to end very well for me. So,
yeah,
I just want, you know, that was one of those great lessons. And then I stalked that deer 4 other times throughout the season. And every single time I'd get in there, he'd stand up in the brush. And I'm not kidding. This deer, that first time that I had him at 13 yards when he stood up out of the brush. I'd snuck right into the middle of a herd, totally on accident because I misread my landmarks from, you know, almost 2 miles away. So I got in there and I was way too close. When deer stood up, I literally had deer stand up behind me that I had snuck past. And I am literally in the middle of this herd. A buck walks by so close that, I mean, I had an arrow knocked. I could have probably stabbed him with an arrow. It was so close, but it was just high brush. And I apparently had fully engaged stealth mode that day. So much to my chagrin, but when he stood up, he was at 13 yards, but all I had was his head and neck above the brush. And those other 4 stalks, again, he'd stand up and all I'd have is head and neck in that brush. So yeah, just a frustrating one.
But. Yeah, no, I hear you. There is something to that. It feels like when you get within that 40 yard range, it's like that sixth sense is, you know, whatever it is hyper.
Yeah.
Let me run something by you. This is interesting. I would be interested to hear your thoughts. So my dad's in the hospital. So last weekend I went up to see my dad and I have a nephew who is a canine cop in Northern Utah, right? So he's got a canine dog. It's a, you know, drug dog trained to sniff drugs. And, you know, he's basically got a super nose, right? So he was telling my dad relayed this story to him, but it kind of sparked something. It made me think, but he said that a couple weeks ago, they had a suspect that had fled a scene of a crime and took off, and they called this guy, my nephew, in with his dog, and they brought him in to try to trail this guy, right? So they brought him in. They didn't have anything of this suspect to like let the dog sniff to like catch his scent, but he was telling my dad that dog's nose is so sensitive that it can pick up a change in pheromones that are emitted when somebody has a hyper elevated state. So like when their adrenaline spikes, they emit a certain scent. So like they smell stronger, they smell differently. And as he was telling my dad that, I was sitting there thinking, I wonder if there's something to that, because when you're bow hunting and you get tight on an animal, my nerves are going through the roof. Like I'm spiking adrenaline, and I've wondered, like, is there something to that? Do I smell stronger?
I wonder if they can hear my heart beating half the time.
I've wondered that too. Yeah. But that one really had me scratching my head. And I was like,
that is so cool.
I wonder if that's that sixth sense that, you know, people talk about. I wonder if you just smell different or stronger.
But we just don't perceive it.
Yeah, yeah. We just don't perceive it. But it has to do with adrenaline. So I know we do a Mythbusters episode every now and then on our other podcast. So I think I'm going to dive into that and see.
I'm totally in on that one. I'm all about that, because there is something. There is definitely something. Sure. And don't get me wrong, I know they've seen me, I know they've smelled me, and I know they don't hear me as much. I've gotten to where I'm pretty good at concealing that noise, whether it's double socks or sneak techs or Gulo stalkers. Dude, I've got them all, and I've deployed every single one of them in different cases, and they've all worked for me. But man, there is just something that they catch on. And that makes so much sense, because without a doubt, you are locked in, as my son would say. You know, I mean, absolutely locked in on the situation. You are just sitting there waiting for something, you know, waiting for those antlers to dip before he stands up, you know. Man.
Let me, something I wanted to ask you. You're a pretty good shot with a bow and arrow. So I know that you've competed quite a bit. I follow your Instagram, and you're probably one of those guys that, like, whenever
I pull out my bad arrows before I post the good
ones. I know you're lying. I know you know. I know you're a good shot, but you're a guy that I constantly see, and I'm like, man, he's crushing, man. He shoots so good. So I was curious as to how do you, like, do you have any tips or tricks to maintaining your composure? And specifically on mule deer, because mule deer for me, it's like, I feel like I can shoot an elk, and I've gotten to a point where I feel like I'm a little bit more composed than I might be. But for some reason, and I hear this from a lot of people, a big mule deer just has people in a way that a lot of other animals don't.
Yeah. And I think part of it is the way you hunt them. You know, when the elk come in charging and stuff, you know, that's, there's a fair amount of adrenaline there, but you kind of know what that is. Sitting on a mule deer is just different, man. Yeah. Sitting there waiting for a buck to stand is, oh my gosh, it's just so nerve wracking. And there's a couple things that I've started doing that have made a big difference for me. Number one is making sure I have a camelback with me on the stock. So there, Badlands makes this little tiny pack. And I mean, it's literally the size of like my 3-liter water bladder. Mm-hmm. And then you shove snacks in there and that's pretty much it. So when I go on a stalk now, and I literally, I just roll that thing up and it rolls up to something about that big and about that long, which you can't really tell. It's, mm-hmm. I don't know, about 9 inches long and, you know, about 4 inches in diameter at the most. And I will, before I go on a final stock at about 300-400 yards, I'll put my pack, or, you know, I'll put my water bladder in that, a snack, a knife, and I'll just go.
Gotcha.
And that has made such a difference for me, because I've sat there and gotten cottonmouth so bad.
Right.
Just, and it's not because of the exertion. It's not because of the heat. It's not all those things. It's the freaking emotions that are going on inside of you that's just driving you crazy. So having the ability to sit there and take a drink and just catch your breath and sit down and just relax and be able to control your emotions a little bit, that's step one. Now, step two, and again, I stole this from Randy Ulmer years ago, is to focus on one element of your shot. So when I draw back, I might have taken a shot at a buck a long time ago where I couldn't remember if I'd like used a pin or if I'd looked through a peep or, I mean, I know that I got like back to this area, but I don't know if I went like this or if I just went like that, or I have no idea. So for me, I will focus on hitting my anchor. Because as soon as I hit my anchor, that peep, the nose is on the string, the eyes looking through the peep, I know I've kind of called everything into order and everything's kind of working in the right direction. So I focus on that. I focus on that. And then it's a matter of just feeling that shot work.
Gotcha.
So, and I practice it every friggin' time I go to the range. I mean, and you know, if I go to a mule deer target, I look at it, I'm like, there it is. That's about we've got a range that's like 10 minutes from my house here. I'm pretty, pretty fortunate. That's a year round 3D range. And there's a 3D target, 3D buck target at 45 yards, but you can back up and shoot that thing, you know, from 80 if there's nobody around, and just about every distance in between, it's a pretty cool shot. And I will literally put myself in that situation and say, and even if I'm with friends, it doesn't matter. I mean, they'll see me just, again, it's kind of that lock in sort of thing, you know, where I'm focused. I know what I'm preparing myself for, and I will absolutely focus on making that shot as if there was, you know, 180-inch buck, or, well, in my case, probably 165 to 170-inch buck standing out there.
It is funny when you go to practice, and one of the questions I wanted to get to was practice and how you practice, but it's interesting when you go to just shoot your bow, you go, I've got a range up here, the Kenyon, and it's funny how you step up to a 3D target. A lot of days you just like draw your bow back and shoot arrows, but if you induce, if you induce that into your mind, here's an actual hunt situation. You imagine, you know, okay, maybe I've got a mule deer and he's walking left to right. You know, he steps out and I'm imagining it in my mind. Right. It is really interesting how much different that feels.
Yes.
Even though it's the same situation, you're still shooting a foam deer up at the range that you've shot 1,000 times. It is interesting how just imagining it and working those situations through your mind feels so much different than it does normally.
It's completely different. It comes down to the whole practice how you play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're out there shooting arrows with a purpose, you will accomplish good things. If you're just out there shooting arrows, you're just shooting arrows. But if you spend the time to commit to it, then it can change dramatically.
How do you practice? How many do you have? Do you set a goal for a certain number of arrows a day? Do you keep score? Do you do anything like that?
I do like to keep score. That's one of the things that has been really, really key for me. Even if I'm just shooting my Thursday night league, mm-hmm. up at No Limits, I keep score on my app every single time, just so I know where I am, and I know, and I'll go back and I'll look at them, and I hold myself accountable to it. You know, hey, if I have a crap night, you know, you sit there and you think about it. All right, what was wrong? What didn't go according to plan today? And then start coming up with a plan to overcome that. Mm-hmm. And that's what it takes, you know. But I used to do a lot of blank bale work, mm-hmm. and that's truly how I overcame target panic. I had what Aaron Snyder described as a raging case of target panic. Yep. And I can't argue with him, because it was bad. It was ugly, man. I was punching a hinge, and man, when it was right, oh, it was a thing of beauty. But unfortunately, the next day it could, if I had a 2-day tournament, boy, I saw both sides of that coin. Yeah. And sometimes in the same round. I mean, I've spent a lot of time doing blank bale work, and I know what my shot's supposed to feel like. But until you know what it's supposed to feel like, you're just shooting arrows.
Yeah. Yeah. There's myself included. So I'm going to put myself in this same bus, but I felt like I same thing, raging case of target panic, probably 12, 13 years ago at this point. I did the same thing you did. Sounds like I basically took my sight off and blank bailed, went to a hinge. I don't think I shot an arrow more than 5 yards with a sight for probably like 8 or 9 months. Like, I just blank bailed forever.
Took me 90 days.
Yeah. In my basement. And that's all I did. And I felt like on the backside of that, you know, I shot some indoor leagues here when we had it. We had a little bit better, you know, archery club. It was a little bit more active. We had indoor. I felt like I improved there. I had a buddy that I used to go up and I would shoot with pretty consistently. And there was like a little, not competitiveness, but a little bit, you know, we'd get to like every other target. And he'd be like, hey, I'll bet you a soda on this one, you know, closest to the center, you know, wins. And there was like that little bit of a nerve and like a little bit of competition induced. And I felt like I progressed and I got better. And I was going to some local 3Ds that were here in Utah. This was before my kids got old enough that like every single weekend they're doing something. But I used to go to like, the rodeo arena 3Ds, and I would shoot probably 5 or 6 of those from, you know, December all the way through the spring. And I felt like I was progressing, like I was getting better for sure. Like I was becoming a better shot, but I felt like since that time frame, I kind of plateaued and I've never really gotten any better. And potentially I maybe even got a little bit worse. I know for sure I need to go to the eye doctor.
Oh, I have.
My right eye is definitely not what it used to be. I need to get to the doctor and get some glasses or contacts figured out. But I was curious, like how do people get better? Because I hear that all the time. So, you know, I have friends that are, you know, professional archers, and it feels like those guys, Do you know Henry Bass at all? Do you know Henry at all? Yeah.
I know who he is. Yeah.
So I used to shoot with Henry back in the day, and there were times when I felt like Henry's better than I am, but he's not so much better, you know? But then all of a sudden,
there's a gap, but it's you could span it. Yeah. Then, if you were,
it felt like all of a sudden I'm like, oh, this guy's in another atmosphere. Like, he's way better than me. So I was curious, do you have any tips or tricks, anything that you felt like in your personal life that has made you, like, given you those increases in your accuracy?
Absolutely. Okay. Shoot less arrows.
That's interesting.
Okay. Now I'm going to couple that with shoot more arrows, but here's the thing. When I was really shooting my best, mm-hmm. I was shooting more blank bale arrows than I was aimed arrows. And so my process was flawless. And I used to let down a lot. I'd be sitting there at full draw, pulling on the middle. And if it just wasn't feeling right, just let it down. If I held too long, let it down. But my attitude, and when I really shot my best, I was shooting a lot of blank bale arrows at home in my basement. And then when I would go to the range, I'd shoot 20 arrows.
Mm-hmm.
But I would focus on executing 20 perfect shots. No ancillary arrows just for arrow count. I would focus on going out there and literally making, and you've got to start somewhere. And truly, I think it's important how you do this and how you approach it. I think, first of all, leaving on a good note is vital, because when you leave, your last arrow you shoot has a lasting impression on your mind. And so if I'm at the range and I am struggling, and there's those days where it feels like a foreign object in your hand. You're like, have I ever actually arched before? Have I ever done this? And though on those days, I will literally say, all right, here it is. I'm going to make one perfect shot. And then I'm going home. I'm out. I'm done. And I mean, that's what it took for me, is I would sit there and just not accept less than my best results, not accept less than my best effort. So if I'm out there and I'm really struggling, I'm just going to make that one perfect shot and I'm heading out. Yeah. And I'm going to think about that one perfect shot more than I'm going to think about the 20 crap shots that led me to saying I need to make one perfect shot and then leave. But go into the range and then just focusing on perfect execution of as many shots as you can. And then as soon as you feel it start to slip, make one more good one and then head out.
Yeah.
And that's why, people are always giving me crap. Why are you always posting pictures of your arrows and targets? Like, dude, I do that for me. That's not for you. That's for me.
That's for me.
I want to go back there and I want to look at that. And I want to be able to go back to myself and say, I nailed that shot. And so it's for my own self-esteem. It's for my own process. So yeah, that's it. When people look at it and say, oh, you're just doing that out of arrogance and stuff. I mean, I guess maybe kinda, but it's all part of that process though.
Yeah. What you're saying makes a lot of sense to me, because I often think, I don't have a problem aiming. I have a problem with consistent execution, meaning for me, it's mostly my back half. So my release hand, it's consistent, anchoring to the exact same angle in my hand.
The choir.
Yeah. It's consistent execution of my release the exact same way every single time. It's shot timing. And I feel like I don't really necessarily have a problem aiming. I feel like the problem is almost always, at least for me, in accuracy is mostly in my back half. So, I mean, what you're saying makes a ton of sense.
Same.
So that's where you work that out, right? As you work it out, blank belling in your basement, where you're just basically working on execution and not aiming.
Well, and again, you just nailed exactly why I tell myself as I draw back, hit that anchor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm drawing back on a buck, I feel that anchor. And as soon as I feel that, I know everything's going to be fine. Because like you said, my front end of my shot's never really been in question, mm-hmm. but that back end has definitely had some flaws over the years.
Yeah.
So that's why I focus on that. And that's exactly, you nailed it.
That's good. Good advice. I wanted to ask you, are you a tinkerer at all? Do you spend much?
No, heck no. You're not? No, I don't have 3 different releases sitting here at my desk or anything. Kidding me?
What about your bow though? What about tune?
Okay, so here's a funny thing. I actually have driven a few people a little bit crazy when it comes to like tuning bows. I'll tune my bow and then I do not think about tuning my bow again. I truly won't. I'll go back to, you know, I'll shoot it through paper again, maybe a week or two before the season, mm-hmm. after I've shot broadheads. And, you know, especially if I'm not getting exactly the results I'm looking for, I'll go back, make sure everything's good there. Dude, I know for a fact my bow, if it's 90% tuned, will shoot better than I will if I'm not doing my part. So I tend to spend more time working on my shot than I do working on my bow. I am a chronic release tinkerer,
yeah.
which is weird because I shot the same release for like 15 years. But I shot that release until my truck got broken into last year and all 5 of them that I had got stolen. So it forced me down a different rabbit hole and I'm shooting the stands now. And I went with these because I've got, this is the thumb, mm-hmm. which I've shot nothing but the thumb for the last 2 weeks. Gotcha. My goal is to shoot a deer in Arizona with the thumb. Mm-hmm. I've never killed anything with the thumb release.
Really?
Every single thing I've killed has been with a hinge or, well, actually with a spike release and then a hinge mm-hmm. this last year. So
yeah
just kind of weird, but I've decided that the accuracy that I get when I execute a good shot with a thumb is just, it's dumb. I mean, it's just, it's crazy how that there's this incremental step between me with the hinge, which has always been good and it's always been consistent. But my gosh, dude, if I can make that same shot, if I've got time to execute that same technique with the thumb, it's scary.
Yeah.
So I owe it to myself to try it. That's how I do it.
I did a podcast a few weeks ago with a guy and he was asking me about releases because I'm going the other way. So I've shot a thumb button the last 2 years to hunt with, and I'm actually going to, and just like you, prior to that, I would only use a hinge for probably 10 years.
Yeah.
And I'm actually headed back the other way. I'm going to go back to my hinge, but it's, I don't want to jinx you or anything.
I might too.
But
hopefully I don't do it after one really poorly executed shot.
One of the things he asked me was, why did you go to a thumb button? And it's very similar to you. I think I'm more consistent over more arrows with a hinge, but I'm more accurate with a thumb button.
Takes one, right?
Then it just takes one. The hard part of that is like actually making that thing work the way that you want it to in the moment.
And so are you executing, and now I'll turn into podcast host for a second.
Yeah, go for
it. Now Trail, tell me, how do you execute a shot with a thumb? How do you execute a shot with a hinge?
I try to execute them essentially in the same way, right? So wrap my thumb a little bit over the top of the thumb barrel. And to me, I try to replicate a real similar feeling in that I'm trying to relax my forearm, my wrist, my bicep. I'm trying to kind of use my rhomboid, and I'm just basically kind of dragging, if you will, my thumb across the barrel to activate it. And there's a lot of times it's when I'm at the range, and I told this guy when he asked me the question, most of the time when I'm at the range, I don't have any issues. Like I can really shoot that thing pretty accurately at the range, but I've had some issues in the field. And I think part of it is probably just confidence. And, I don't know, but I've had some issues with the thumb button in the field, and I've killed some animals too. I've had no problems on other animals. So to me, it's like, which is more important, like, is it this consistency? And I just feel like I'm more consistent with a hinge. And one of the things that I think, this is just me personally speaking, I don't want to project this onto anybody else, but I think for me, I must be like a little bit more manic than some folks in the moment. And I need that hinge to like force me to slow down.
That's the beauty of it. Yeah. If you're shooting that hinge properly,
mm-hmm.
it forces your best effort to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's kind of why I'm going back. I'm like you, I'm a constant tinker with releases. I'm kind of like you. I typically will buy.
I've owned them all, man.
Yeah. I'll buy in bunches. I just bought two not that long ago and, you know, added two and probably sold a couple others. But I agree with you about, which is why I wanted to ask you. And I'm a tinkerer. So, I mean, like last night I had my bow. I've got that new Matthews Lift X, and I had it in the press in and out and kind of working with cam timing and, you know, basically cut the D-loop off and replaced the knock point and kind of leveled thing out and retuned it. And I'm always playing with stabilizers, it feels like. But
most, oh, gosh.
Yeah.
I'm picking up new rods tomorrow, and here comes the rabbit hole.
most people that I know, though, that are very good shots, and I remember we had Kyle Douglas on the podcast last February, and I remember asking him, and he's like, you know, I'll set up a bow. I'll get it to where I feel like it fits me and it shoots good and it's accurate. And he's like, and then I'm done with it. I just shoot it. He said he won Vegas. And I think he said the one time he won Vegas, he said that bow had probably a 1/4 inch tail high, you know, high left hair in it. And he's like, but that bow was just set up and was just shooting really good. It grouped really, really well for me. And yeah. He's like, I could have tuned that tear out, but it just didn't make
sense. Why mess with success? Why? You know, why mess with something that's working? And it's funny. I had my last year that I shot primes, I went into the shop like a week before the season, and one of the guys there was just kind of hanging out with me. And I went over to the little tunnel where they have the paper tuner, and I shot through, and like, much like Kyle's, mine was a little high, a little left. Mm-hmm. And the guy goes, all right, well, let's go. And I'm like, yeah, we're not touching that bow. We are not touching this bow. This bow is ready to kill a deer, and it will not be messed with. I mean, it's, and literally I did not. I'm like, hey, I know that thing has at least a 1/4 inch high, mm-hmm, and a 1/4 inch left tear, but that bow is absolutely hitting behind the pin. Mm-hmm. And I know my abilities to understand that I can't get better than I was shooting out of that bow. So yeah, there was nothing to be gained. I mean, he just goes, wait, you're going to hunt with that? I'm like, no, I'm going to go kill a deer with this. And I'll never forget the look on his face. He looked at me. He's like, you got to be kidding me. That'd drive me insane. I'm like, yeah. I feel no apprehension in this at all, because yeah, I've seen the way this bow is aiming. And that's, for me, my biggest thing is I want to build a bow that aims well, because I know if it's going to hold in the middle, all I have to do is execute my shot consistently. So that just eliminates a giant variable out of it.
How do you build a bow that aims well? Like, what for you are the specs of a bow? Is it axle length? Is it draw length? Does it draw weight? Is it let off?
So to some extent, yeah, you get into like some holding weights that, you know, and I've been a 75% let off guy for a very long time. I mean, you know, when I shot those primes, I mean, dude, you could set that let off so high that you could lock the friggin' cams, yeah. You know, and you can hold the bow like there, and the weight of the bow is holding it at full draw. That's not me, man. I don't shoot like that. I'm more of an active puller. Yep. So I want to have something that I'm pulling against. But having said that, I've started building my bows differently over the years. And really, I'll start out, I know what I want that bow to feel like. And they almost always end up with a slight tip back when you hold the bow by the neck of the grip. Mm-hmm. They'll always have just kind of a slight tip back towards the back, but it's not much. And here's a spot where you and I are going to differ in opinions, Trail, and that's okay. I'll still like you, even though you're wrong. I'm a guy who, if I'm shooting a 6-arrow quiver, I'm going to shoot every single arrow throughout the entire year with 5 arrows in that quiver, because yeah, I am preparing for that one shot. So I will literally have one empty hole in my quiver that I'll shoot with year round. So and I'm going to go to tournaments competing in the open class and with my bow quiver on, and I get laughed at and I get it. But years ago, I decided I wanted to be accurate with one bow.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have that one bow be the bow that I did absolutely everything with, because who wouldn't want their most accurate bow to be their hunting bow? Right.
Sure.
I mean, if you're going to deliver one shot, but I'll start out with zero stabilizers on the bow, put the quiver on, 'cause I know that's going to be there. I'll hit full draw. I'll see where the aiming patterns are. And then, I mean, the first thing I'm going to do is just put a small front rod on there, and I'm going to start adding weight a little bit at a time. And again, just charting and seeing how that thing is holding. Mm-hmm. And then if it feels like I'm starting to get a little front heavy on that, but it's aiming well, I'll put a back bar on there. And again, start adding weight as needed until you find that happy place. And it could be a high stabilizer mount. It could be the low mount on the Hoyts, you know, I mean, you're kind of chasing it, and it's so personal, you know, it's so personal to how you grip, how you anchor. And I think equally importantly is how you're executing your shot. If you're a puller, you've got to have it set up a little differently than somebody who's just shooting a really static shot.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's great advice. I'm glad I knew you'd have an answer. That's why I asked.
Well, I hunted for like 3 years with a bow that this Prime Logic that it was I'd always shot long bows.
Yep.
And I hit a branch with my upper limb on my bow years ago. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try to shoot a short bow. So I got an Alpha Max 32. And what I realized is I could shoot that bow just as well as the 38 inch bow that I'd been shooting.
Yep.
And so one of the things that I've come to realize about my own personal style is that I would love a 7 inch brace height.
Yeah.
That's like my happy place. Axle to axle length is not quite as important to me, because I know I can kind of manipulate D loop length and draw length to still get the anchors to feel right. And when I say anchors, I mean nose on the string, you know, and your hand feeling right. So it's not back here. It's, you know, in there on your jawline. And so, I mean, I know that. But that 7 inch brace height for me, I've got kind of a bad shoulder on my draw shoulder. So I want something that at 7 inches, look at it this way. You're starting the draw process here rather than here with a 6 inch. So you're just pulling it less distance back.
Right.
And I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it might be a placebo effect, but I mean, it matters to me, and that's what I go with. But.
Do you shoot 70 pounds mostly?
I've found over the last couple of years, I just want a little bit more holding weight. In fact, I had a buddy who 3D printed some draw stops for some Hoyt cams that you could get that holding weight. You could get that to about, that led off to about 70%.
Gotcha.
Oh my gosh. I was so happy. I just felt like I felt like an active participant in the shot again.
Nice. 'Cause
if the let off gets too high for me, I get lazy on the back end, and I want a bow that kind of demands a little bit more out of me.
Yep.
So in other words, most people who grab my bow and say, "Hey, let me try," you know, they want to try to shoot my bow. I'm like, you're probably not going to love this.
Yeah. Wanting to jump on them a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. I've had you for an hour and a half or so, I guess. I appreciate your time. I feel like I could talk to you forever. I feel like we could.
Oh, yeah. Hey, this is never a struggle for me to talk archery.
We'll have to get together sometime where we can just shoot the bull and compare. We actually got to try to get together and go shoot sometime. So maybe if there's ever
love to
shoot in Colorado that we can make it out to, that'd be fun to do.
Yeah.
But, I appreciate you coming on. I'll cut you loose, and I'm grateful for your time. I think you fulfilled all my expectations and more. You had a lot of, You had a lot of really good tips, and I feel like you're a guy, like I said, that I could pick your brain for a long time, but I appreciate the hour and a half that you gave me. So thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
And good luck. Good luck. This application season. It's time to get
your application. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Thanks. This year I should be in the driver's seat for a deer tag here, and I'll be playing catch up and hoping to get lucky for elk. But yeah, my son and I are actually heading to Arizona in January. Cool. That'll be his first archery hunt. So cool. We're really, really excited for that. So
good deal. Well, good luck to you guys. I feel like
we're going
to
need it.
I feel like this application season's like for people that don't gamble or play the lottery, this is the next best
this
thing
is it.
And probably even better. So good luck in the draws and good luck in Arizona. And I appreciate your time and I hope to run into you sometime.
Absolutely. That sounds great, Trail.
All right. Thanks, Henry. See you.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks.